Welcome to Tee Talk, where athletes share their stories. Join us as we explore the profound connections between sports, community, and the human experience.
I want to welcome you to Tee Talk, Mr. Harold Asher, a Tulane football player, a football great, as I understand it to be.
Sounds like you were talking to my mama and daddy.
Well, maybe I was, but no, I was talking to some of the players who all had a lot of respect for you. So, first things first, which years did you play and what sports did you play?
I played football. I went there in 1969. Okay. 1970, I was on the team but didn't get enough snaps to letter, but I lettered in 71 and 72. That's 1972, okay. Not 1872.
Well, that's good. So you did get to go to the bowl game then, is that
right?
That's
correct. We went to the Liberty Bowl team. I was on the Liberty Bowl team, and we beat Colorado, was it 17-3 or something like that, back in 1970.
Awesome. So, you know, what was your life like prior to coming to Tulane?
Oh, gee whiz.
What was high school like? What was your family like? What was all that about?
Okay, I'm from Bogalusa, Louisiana. Played for the Lumberjacks. My senior year, we were undefeated, lost in the playoffs. The next year.
What position did you play in high school? Because I know sometimes everybody played all over the place.
I was a defensive end.
Okay.
I was my senior year strapping 5'10", 175-pound defensive end, which is about what I weighed when I signed with Tulane in February of 1969. So my last year was 68. Between the time that I signed in February and the time I reported in August, I grew to 6 feet tall, which is my current height, and put on 55 pounds. I was 230 when I reported.
55 pounds?
Yep.
How did that happen? Like, what?
I was a late developer. Eating a lot, lifting weights, running. I had worked construction, so I was adding fat and muscle. But
he said fat and muscle.
Eating a lot of hamburgers. So,
Oh my goodness.
Those were the days.
Did they have McDonald's back then in Bogalusa?
I think we had a burger chef, but we did have Frosthop. You know, like Ted's Frosthop?
Okay. Yes.
So I could down a few corn dogs, which were very popular back then, and whatever kind of sandwiches they had. The drinking age was 18, and of course I adhered to that. I never had a beer or anything.
Okay.
At least a beer before, I don't know, 3 p.m. So no, it was a country town. Football was big there. I don't know if I said this or not. The year after I left, they won the state championship in the highest classification.
Okay.
Which seemed to be what happened as soon as I left, they won the state championship. And I was on the team in 1972 that lost to LSU 9-3 at the 1 foot line.
Wow.
If only Steve Foley had led the fullback, Bill Huber, instead of a terrible pass that he threw. And I'm saying that because I love Steve. We'd have won that game, but they won. After I left, they beat LSU the next year. So it's a recurring thing.
Okay.
Get me out of there, and they have football success.
Yes, indeed. So did you only play football in high school?
I played football, and I played golf. That's all. I was terrible in every other sport.
So what was your family like?
My father and I were best friends. Okay. I had two sisters and a mother and a dog. And had, you know, coach back then. My father was my biggest fan. I don't think he missed a practice or a game.
Wow, he came to the practices?
Yeah. He wanted to beg the coach to put me in. So we were best friends all throughout my youth growing up through college. He was my best man at my wedding. Lived till 97 years old.
Wow. So what was one of your favorite childhood memories or traditions that you guys used to do?
Dinner.
Okay.
Every time we ate, I was happy. No, we would just hang out, you know, watch sports. I would play golf. He would come and hang with me when I'd play golf occasionally. And, you know, it was just, he was like my best friend.
So what type of career, you said you guys almost won the state championship in high school, but what type of career did you have personally? Like, were you captain? What type of accolades did you receive?
I was a co-captain my senior year. Wasn't widely recruited. The one school that if I hadn't gone to Tulane, I was recruited by West Point. And
okay.
In 1968, that was the height of the Vietnam War.
So what was that like?
Well, craziness.
So you had to register, correct?
Yeah, of course. Fortunately, I had a high draft number. So
okay.
I wasn't drafted, but I had a number of friends that were drafted. None of my friends that I know of were killed, but some of the people that were older than I was were injured. It was a crazy time, very, very divisive.
So how did you feel about it? Like, how did you feel about the war? What do you recall your thoughts being about having to register?
Well, back then, the nation was divided, and I guess I was a patriot. I believed what I was getting on the national news. The government was feeding misinformation about what we were doing, what our objectives were in the war. As you read the lies that were coming out of Washington. And
did you realize it was lies at the time?
No.
Or you were just taking it in?
I was accepting it. It was coming from reliable sources. Back then we didn't have the internet. It was coming from Chet Huntley and David Brinkley and Walter Cronkite. You might have heard of those guys. Those were our national organizations that fed us purportedly the truth. So it was unpatriotic to not support the troops, not support the government. My father had served in the military. You had to support the military and support our troops. So that was my bend as well.
So by you getting off it, was it West Point?
Yeah.
So was it just that your family was just really patriotic? What was that about your dad that caused him to feel so patriotic about the country during that time?
Well, he served in World War II. He went over to Europe and fought. And he told me stories about his friends that he had lost in the war and the ones that survived the war. That was a big part of his life. So he was very, very supportive of all of our servicemen, which I am and have always been. Even it's not the servicemen that are the issue, it's the government policy that's established. You know, they
correct.
They follow the orders of the commander in chief. So
did your dad know Neil Jones?
He did not. No.
Okay. And did you ever get the opportunity to meet him?
Was he the Vietnam vet that
he was the one that was the World War. He was captured. So I want to say
he was captured in Vietnam and released. He served in Vietnam, and I think he actually came to Tulane while I was there. I did not get to meet him, but I think I may have been either at a ceremony that he attended or something like that.
Yeah, he was really involved with Tulane and the T Club and all of that. So, yeah. So I know you guys, that 71 team is really close-knit and tight, and you guys are always involved in things.
Well, I was on the 72 team, and I'm certainly a lot of my good friends on the 71 team, on the 70 team, the 72 team, the 73 team. We only had a few really quality athletes, but we won from we were tough, we hit hard, we hit often, and we had a lot of camaraderie and teamwork. So that was our key to success.
Cool. So you had choice between West Point and Tulane. What made you choose Tulane?
I was always a Tulane fan growing up, for whatever reason. I actually, as a child, I'd gone and seen LSU. I went to My parents took me to two games where LSU beat Tulane 62-0. In the second game, they had 60-0, and they went for two. So it was at that point that I developed my hatred for LSU and my love for Tulane. I've always been an underdog lover. So when Tulane offered me, I immediately accepted.
Awesome. Did you come on a recruiting trip, or was – when was your first time on campus?
I went on a recruiting trip. It was the Tulane LSU game, my senior year in high school. And you don't want to hear anything about that because they showed us a different side of campus life than.
What was that like?
Well,
Harold,
we went down.
What was that like? What was a recruiting trip like in 1969?
It was in 68, like? Because I came in 68.
Yeah.
So
what was that recruiting trip like?
I came with my teammate Lewis Murray, who was also recruited, and Bruce McGehee, who was recruited from a high school team. So three of us were recruited. We met some other guys from New Orleans. There were also recruits, and some of the players piled us in a car. We went down to the quarter.
What kind of car was it?
I don't know. It probably was enough to comfortably hold five people. Maybe.
And how many did y'all have in there?
I would say we had maybe 9 or 10. And it was a different kind of experience, you know, being 17 or 18 years old. It's a little bit different than being the maturity that you would have, of course, when you're a freshman or a sophomore in school. So it was different times back then.
Exactly. The drinking age was 18.
Or if you came from Bogalusa, the drinking age was if you could put your money up on
the cup.
Put your money up on the counter for the guy to give you your parts of a Budweiser.
Exactly. That's funny. Yeah. So where did y'all go on your recruiting trip?
Well, I came to New Orleans, and we went down to the French Quarter. And we went to a couple of the clubs. I think they're now referred to as gentlemen clubs. but we were toothless folks. We didn't know what we were doing. We just went there and stayed out late.
To see the sights.
Saw the sights, yeah. We came in on a Saturday, went to the game, went out after the game, and then met the coaches on Sunday and came back home.
Did they take you to any classes? Did you go to any classes on your recruiting trip? Or was just the game and the quarters because it was the weekend?
The game and the quarter, and then saw the coaches and figured out if they were going to be foolish enough to offer me a scholarship, I'd darn sure take it. So,
did everybody on a recruiting trip come?
I know that Glenn Harder was there, who was one of my best friends, was and still is. As I said, Lewis, Murray, and I can't remember who else was a part of our group. So not everybody did come, but a few of them. One of my teammates – Bruce McGeehee went to LSU instead.
Okay. So how many players were on the team at that time?
On the freshman team that they signed? On the...
So explain to me the difference between a freshman team and then the varsity team. Okay.
Back in the old days, leather helmets, etc.
Were you wearing a leather helmet, Harold?
I did not wear a leather helmet. We had those good Rydell helmets, and it was a badge of honor getting your bell rung. Now they call it a concussion. Back then, it was getting your bell rung. But
just got some smelling salts and ran back on the field.
Get back in there. You're not. You can't miss any plays. So back then they had a freshman team, and my freshman team, they signed 63 players.
Wow.
With the objective, and they didn't tell us this when they were recruiting us, that they only wanted to keep around 20. So Jim Pittman was the head coach. He came from the University of Texas. His head coach, while he was an assistant at the University of Texas, was a guy by the name of Daryl Royal. And there's a great book called Meat on the Hoof. It's old. It's probably, I think it's written on parchment. but it tells the story of how different football was back then than it is now. It was really contact many, many days, lots of contact, lots of drills. You would have practices, long practices. They would single out, in my freshman group, they would single out groups of fellas that they wanted to give extra practice to that generally involved a lot of contact, with the idea that you were going to come to your senses and realize that you were not one of the 20 that they wanted to keep.
So was this a new coach coming in? Like, why would he sign 63 people when he really only wanted 20?
He wanted to get 20 tough kids. So that was the way that he would do it. You would go in and get as many people as you could and figure out. You had, out of my class, they had maybe 5 or 6, maybe 10 that were really good athletes. The rest of us were just would get out there and try and tough it out.
Okay. Awesome. So then
they have it, the athletes, there are lots of them. I mean, too, like now that you look at their team, they look like all of them are athletes.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. So you come on campus. What's the first thing you did when you got on campus? Did you go to your dorm? Did you go to practice? The weight room? What happened when you arrived?
They dropped us off, went to our dorm room, tried to figure out what the heck is going on, looking around, didn't know anything. And then we started practice the very next day.
What was your dorm room like compared to your home?
It was a little bit larger than a closet, Robert Sharp Hall. I think the dorm's still there.
It's still there.
There were two to each room. You had a closet, I think something above you to put your stuff, and a bed. And that was it. It was not luxurious, but it was effective.
So did you come from a luxurious upbringing? Were you like, what is going on here?
Our family had a house. It was a large house, maybe 1,500 square feet, 3 bedrooms. Okay.
Did you have your own room?
I had 2 sisters. I wasn't going to be in a room with them.
Right.
And, it was a small house, very simple. We lived very simple, but nice. It was wonderful. And, it was not luxurious in any means, by any means. So, except maybe by Bogalusa standards, but Bogalusa.
So then you go into Sharp. Did you go to Brough Commons that day, or did you not?
Yeah, we probably went to Brough. You're asking me from Let's see, 1950s.
I know.
'50s.
I know. I'm just trying to think about that first, your first thoughts when you came to Tulane.
What in the hell have I done?
So was it looking at the other players and measuring up, or was it just, you know, being in the city, coming from both?
It was just, you know, you come from being, having being known for your capabilities, and you know what is expected from you, and then all of a sudden you're in a very strange situation. So it's just a lack of support, if you will. You're just on your own for the first time.
So when you get to practice and the coaches are, you know, being hard, extra hard, what was that like compared to what you experienced in high school?
Let's see. Our coach was very different. I'm hesitant to give the full picture. He was not a warm and fuzzy situation. But, you know, you're surrounded by 63 other guys who are all in the same situation. So we, you quickly develop a bond of friendship and brotherhood and family amongst your players. Your coaches were really not your friends, except for a very few really good players we had on the team. We had some wonderful athletes, but people who had very little skills like myself, they challenged us.
So, Harold, I hear you, but the one of the people that talked very highly of you was Charlie Hall. Can you kind of explain to me your relationship with Charlie and what that was like playing with those guys and what all the hoopla was coming around them? If anything, like, was anything said? When I say Charlie Hall, he was in that group that was the first African-American football players to sign scholarships.
Right.
So what was that like?
Well, we had had a black player my freshman class, Raymond Burgess. You and I have spoken about this before.
Right.
He lasted not very long. The coach was not a very welcoming person to our fellow teammates. So Raymond made the decision at that point to leave. So this is 1969, 1970. We had no black players. 1971, we had no black players. Well, although we played a national schedule and the other teams had black players. So in my junior year, they recruited Charlie and John and Robert Washington, the first three black players. And Charlie and John were defense. I played defense, so I spent more time with them. Robert was on offense, wide receiver. The only time I would see Robert was mostly when he would try to come across the middle. I was an inside linebacker. We try to discourage him from running across the middle. But Charlie and John were just so exceptional as human beings and friends and players that you could see why they were selected to be the trailblazers. And, you know, we were very, very good friends. At least I consider them to be good friends, as I do literally everybody that was on the team. So we were a family back then.
Cool. And that's kind of the same thing Charlie and John said. You know, they said you guys just welcomed them with open arms. That was from the team perspective. Did you notice that there were maybe some people on the team that didn't feel the same way, or did everybody kind of accept them on the team?
I can only tell you from my experience. I think everyone accepted them. I heard nobody say anything bad about Charlie or John or Robert. They would say bad things about me, but it was well-deserved.
So it came down, so in your perspective, it came down to, look, they're good. When they line up next to us, we understand why they're there. It wasn't any question or doubt about their ability as players.
No, I mean, when you think about it, this you have to go back to, was it 1971 when they signed? They were the trailblazers. There was no mold that they could fit into. They had no support group. So we as a team became their support group, just as we would for everybody, but even especially for them. I can't imagine what it would have been like, and couldn't back then, to have come to Tulane. It was Tulane at that point was almost entirely white people. They didn't have the diversity that they have now. And I can remember before my senior year, this is a story that I probably shouldn't tell. We were working out in the summer, trying to get ready. We had a, we would all work out in the summer after school.
Right.
And we went to a bar called Friar Tuck's. You may know where it is now. It's on, across from the Ullman Stadium on Claiborne. At least that's where it was. And I can remember Charlie Hall, Alan Zornbrecher, who played on the team. I think Glenn Harder and myself went into Friar Tuck's. It was packed. It was a college bar. And we went on a Friday night or a Thursday night, Tuesday night, Wednesday night, whatever. And the place was packed. And I don't think there had ever been a black in that place before.
Wow.
So Charlie and Glenn and Alan and I sat down at a table in the middle of this very crowded bar, and all of a sudden, everybody was on one side of the room, and we had the whole other half of the bar to ourselves, which was kind of
wow.
Nice.
Wow. How were the people that were serving you guys?
Well, it was, you'd have to go up to the bar to get it, but no one came and
said anything,
no,
right?
I guess they thought we were looking for trouble, and we wouldn't have. We never looked for trouble.
Why would they think you were looking for trouble?
No, we were just sitting there having a few adult beverages. And
of course, like to say that drinking age was 18, and all of you guys
were over
18 at that time. So it was perfectly legal. It wasn't anything illegal going on.
I don't think the coaches wanted us. Back then, the coaches didn't want you to even drink alcohol at all, period. So, but we didn't always listen to the coaches. So, but we went in there and, I think many athletic teams, most athletic teams, most successful athletic teams treat their team as a family. And we were a family.
Right.
And we were older.
So did y'all go like to each other's homes for the holidays? How did you guys interact off? That's one instance. How did you guys interact outside of the playing field?
I know Charlie came to my house once or maybe twice for barbecues in the summer or whatever. I don't recall spending many, other than maybe Glenn Harder, who would come to my house often. We didn't have that kind of a relationship. You know,
well, you were older than them. You were older than them.
Plus, when we had time off, they would go to their own families. They didn't want to go hang around with us old guys.
They didn't want to go to Bogalusa. That's what you're trying to say? Who wanted to go to Bogalusa?
Yeah, well, back then, Bogalusa was much different than it is now. So it was a great place to grow up in.
Is that like a fishing town?
No, it's right now it's a mill town. That unfortunately the people went on strike, and finally the mill union are modernized, and they went from a town of 20,000 that had 6,000 people employed directly by the mill, went to 600 overnight and killed the city.
Oh wow.
Which has happened in many lumber towns.
Okay. So I know you mentioned also that the Vietnam War was going on during the time that you were at Tulane. So what was that like? Were there players getting actually drafted, or
no,
were you pretty much set once you were on campus?
Once you could get a college deferment, 1A, I can still remember. I think it was 1A. And that meant that you got a deferment as long as you were in college or in law school or something like that. And then right before I signed, they instituted the lottery. So, for example, one of my lottery years was, my number was 350, which meant that they would have to go through and draft. That was for each day. So there were 365 numbers. And if you had a high lottery and they were only drafting up to the first 100 days, you knew you were in good shape. So, and that's what they would do every year. They would announce how many days of eligible people were going to be drafted. And as long as you were in college, you could get a deferment.
So earning that college scholarship meant a lot during that time.
Oh, absolutely. It was your ticket not to be drafted, to stay out of Vietnam. It was your opportunity to get a great education. And back then, most of my class actually went on and got almost everybody graduated, and a lot of people went on and got advanced degrees, became lawyers and doctors and engineers. And as I said, we didn't really have the skill set that John and Charlie and Robert had. We knew that our days were going to be over, football playing days were going to be over after college, as opposed to those, they were superior athletes. And I will tell you, if Charlie hadn't hurt his knee, his football, he would have been a star in professionals as well. But back then, they put zippers on your knees that were, eight or 10 inches long, as opposed to little tiny incisions now.
Right.
And blowing out your knee basically was really put the end on certainly on a professional career.
So what was it like in practice? You say Charlie and Robert was, you could tell they were superior. What was it like in practice, practicing with and against them?
Well, Charlie, I was an inside linebacker. Charlie was the defensive tackle, right next to me. So all I had to do was watch Charlie, because he was going to make the tackles regardless of what I did. In 1971, we didn't have a winning team. In 1972, we went 6-5. We should have beat Miami. They beat us on fifth down. We should have beat LSU. They beat us. We lost to them to the last second to 1 foot line. And we were very competitive in literally all of our games.
Okay, wait a minute.
Charlie was the difference.
What do you mean y'all lost on a fifth down? What is that?
You didn't hear that story?
I have, but I would love to hear you tell it.
So we played Miami, and we were up.
And Miami was ranked at the time,
they were
right?
Not. This was, they were not ranked. They had, played 500 ball. They were not a superior team. Although my senior year, we beat Boston College. They were top 25. We beat Georgia, second game. Anyway, we're playing Miami, and we were up late in the game, under a minute to go. They throw a Hail Mary pass at the back of the end zone, and I think our safety could have intercepted it. We just knocked it out of bounds. Back of the end zone on fourth down. We all went off the field, and then the officials say, come back on, and they get another play. It's fourth down. And our coach, Benny Elder, at the time, didn't call timeout. We were not very well organized. We could run back on. They throw a pass in the corner of the end zone, and I think our defensive back may have fallen down. The guy catches it with 40 seconds to go on fifth down, and we lost the game.
Wow.
Yep. So that was a stunner.
That's crazy. Like, that's, I keep hearing it, but I don't even understand how that can happen.
Well,
so between the officials, the coaches, nobody wanted to get that right? Like, was that what we call home cooking?
Yeah, it was home cooking in Miami. To this day, I would like Miami to go 0-12 and go to a bowl game and lose that bowl game. So, you know, their coach, there was a precedent for other fifth downs for forfeiting the game, giving it, but they chose not to because they said that the game wasn't over. They were still, I don't think they had any timeouts left and they had 40 seconds to go. But they said that since the game wasn't over, then they shouldn't. They could have won the game. So life's not fair.
No, it's not. Do you remember any memorable plays that you had?
Any memorable plays that I had?
Yes.
In my football?
Anything stand out? In your football career.
Oh, gee whiz. Nothing individual, you know, it was all part of a team.
Right.
So
was it, which memory stands out the most about you, to you, in terms of your Tulane career?
Oh, golly. It's certainly the friendships, the camaraderie, the brotherhood. To this day, I'm still close friends with the number of my teammates, probably closer to them than anybody in my life. So that's certainly number one. And we had some success in a number of years. We had winning the Liberty Bowl was wonderful. We had some wins, even the first year that Dellinger was there in 71, we had a few highlights. Playing at Notre Dame was exciting, playing at Michigan, although both of them beat us. Beating Georgia was fun. We should have beat LSU, that was fun. I mean, just the whole experience. It's not any particular moment, it was the experience. Getting to know people like that, Charlie.
Yeah. What were some of the biggest crowds that you played in front of?
When we played LSU my senior year, we played, was it 85,000 in Tulane Stadium, if you can believe that. we played in Michigan. They were 100,000, I think.
Wow.
My senior year. It was band day. And we sure gave them a lot to be very happy about for the band to be happy.
Was it ever intimidating to step on those super huge crowds in front of those crowds?
No. I mean,
or were you just like excited to get it, to go out there?
No, it's, you know, being an athlete, you don't hear the crowds. You hear your teammates, your coaches, you're concentrated on what you have to do. And it was, never intimidating. The more intimidating things would be if the other team was doing well against you, you had to come and listen to the coaches scream at you. That was the intimidation.
So Charlie and Robert credit you for mentoring them. So what type of things did you say, because you were older, so what type of things did you say and do to kind of keep them on the, I'll try to say straight and narrow, but, you know, it probably wasn't too straight.
No, I mean, it was.
What were some of the things? What were some of the advice that you gave to them as incoming freshmen or, you know, by you being the older? And I'm assuming you were captain at
no,
that
I was
time.
Not a captain. Well, I was good friends with Glenn Harder, Mike Kuzlin, myself. We had, as I said, we went from 63 down to 20. So this was our fourth year together, all very close, all wanting them to succeed because they're such fabulous guys, and also they're part of the team. You wanted everybody to succeed, but we also recognized that they were special, and they were the first black players that Tulane ever had that were going to be on the field. So the mentoring, when times got tough, you had to just suck it up and get through it. That quitting was not an option. They were too important to their program, to the program, not as it related to wins and losses, but it was easy to recognize that they had to be the trendsetters for future guys. You know, if they're not going to come and let whatever issues that are dealing with them, it's going to be two times harder for the next group. So they owe it to the future black athletes to be tough and not let whatever the problems, because there were a lot of problems. And back then, we would practice and scrimmage and hit literally every practice. It was not easy. And there would be meetings, and then there would be meetings before practice, meetings you would then practice, and then you would meetings after practice, and the coaches were not necessarily as gentle as some of the coaches are now. They were very demanding, largely because they had to be demanding because we didn't have the kind of athletes in great bulk that other teams had. We had a few athletes, but so they had to be tough on us so that we would be tough on the other team. So it was not an easy environment. Plus, you had your schoolwork. So, you know, it was just, you know, telling them you're part of a team and we love you guys and support you. Any problems you got, they're our problems as well as your problems. And you can't quit. You have to be for yourself, for your community, for your team, and also for future others that are going to be following you. And that's what we would tell them constantly. So, and they were.
Did they have other black athletes coming in the following years?
Yeah, or? they were the trendsetters. Right after Charlie and John and Robert, I think that Tulane recognized that, as did many schools, that the black athletes were better athletes than the white athletes. You know, we had maybe had one or two guys that could run below a 4.5, or certainly not below a 4.5. Very few that could run faster than a 4.7 or a 4.8. And wow, that was the way of the game. So the coaches started to realize that you needed to have the athletes, and they had to make the situation more welcoming, which Tulane did. They started, which led to the success the following year when they beat LSU.
So you feel like Charlie and Robert, they had a huge impact on actually getting over the hump of beating LSU?
Robert was offense, so I didn't know Robert as well. Right. But Charlie and John, absolutely.
Charlie and John.
Yeah, I knew we were going to be talking today, so I went and looked at some of the films, and I sent them to you, the LSU game. And you see Charlie, who literally blown his knee out. He's playing on one leg. And he chased their star quarterback down from behind and tackled him on one leg. Their impact on the entire team was huge. And I say that as players, but as people. They were better friends and teammates and people than they were players. And
yeah, I mean, they expressed that they just fit right in, and, you know, everybody just went to war together.
That's the story, and it's because of who they were and what they were. They didn't ask for anything special. They came in. We were all colorblind. We were Tulane football players, and we were a great family, and that's why we did. I think it did had the success that we had, because many teams had much greater talent than we did, but none of them, I don't think, many of them were not tougher than we were, as well prepared, and had the characteristics of a team. And you know, Carmen, that if you have dissension in a team, you're not going to have anything, but if you have that love, everybody pulling the same oar the same way, then you can move mountains, and that's what we did. And Charlie and John were just, they were fabulous.
Excellent, excellent. So, you know, y'all were playing, you were going to class. What did you study at Tulane, and what was it like going to classes, juggling that with your playing?
It was, you know, you had a job to do. You had to play football, and it was a 8 hour or so a day job, 6 days a week. But you also had to, be a student. So I knew I didn't want to go back to Bogalusa, so I wanted to get a degree. I didn't know what I wanted to get a degree in, but I got it in biology. Because I liked my high school biology teacher, who was also my coach. So that's the one thing that I gravitated to. Plus, I was in there with a few of my friends who were biology majors, and we had a good time.
And then what did you do after your biology? Or with your biology?
I didn't know what to do. I knew I wanted to get in the workforce as quickly as I could, so I actually went and got an MBA, a master's at Tulane. Got a degree.
So was that on scholarship? Like, how did that happen?
No, it was partial. I got a partial academic scholarship and paid for half of it. It was extremely expensive when I graduated. I think I had $2,000 in student debt under a 3% loan. So I think it was maybe $1,000 a semester or so about. So this is going back in 1973
and 1974. Right. So you got your MBA?
Got my MBA. Started working for Price Waterhouse at the time. Back in 1975, when I graduated, the Dow Jones Index was at, I think, 700. The inflation was running at 12% and unemployment was running at 10%. Wow. And the only people that were hiring were the accounting firms. So I'm thinking, I think I'll become an accountant, which is what I did.
Awesome. So you just stuck with that for that time?
Well, I got my job. Then shortly after that, I met my wife. She picked me up at Bruno's. Here's another thing that you may not realize, and the players may not realize. When I got married in 1976, I was 25 years old. I was literally the last of my friends to have gotten married at 25.
Right.
So I think it's probably different now. People wait till they're...
They wait.
My kids were in their 30s.
That's amazing. So you met your lovely wife. Did you go back to Bogalusa as an accountant?
No, I stayed in New Orleans. I stayed here. You know, we were in New Orleans, met her, got married, working for a firm. I decided to go out on my own because of my personality. I knew I couldn't take orders my entire life. So I started working on my own, and we had kids, and New Orleans is kind of like standing on mud or quicksand. I'm up to my knees, and then I'm up to my waist, and I'm up here. And now pretty soon, people will think I'm a New Orleanian, but I haven't lived in New Orleans long enough yet.
Oh, my goodness. Now, Harold, I know you've been doing very well. So what type of community service, that type of stuff that you and your family do?
We have always been very, very involved in communal work. When I was young in my career, I was very involved in the Jewish community. I'm Jewish. I was involved in Jewish communal work. After Katrina, both Carol and I got involved in the charter school movement. And then for the past 5 or 6 years, we've both been very involved in an organization that's so dear to our hearts called Son of a Saint that takes care of fatherless boys, primarily in the New Orleans area. And I've been involved in that for, as I said, very involved for the past few years. And it's such an important thing to give back and try and make, as far as we're concerned, try and make the world a better place. So it's been something we've always been involved in.
So being from the Jewish community, working with the Jewish Community Center, what's it like having that network of resources, you know, pooled together? What, how does that impact the way you can move forward in your career, your network? How did that work for you?
Well, I never tried to tap into the Jewish community to tie in my communal work with my professional work. If people wanted to help me, which I did, I had wonderful mentors, and that's who happened to be Jewish, but I don't think that they did it because I was involved. It was, you know, I've just been lucky my entire life to have been surrounded by really, really nice people who wanted to serve as a mentor to me, which is one of the things that I would urge the athletes, the part of the Tulane community. You don't get to where you are by what you do yourself. You're part of a larger group. And the reason that you're there is because someone has pulled you to your position. It's time for you to look back and pay it forward. So we are all blessed. You're blessed. I'm blessed. The people who are going to be watching this are blessed. They need to realize that they got there through someone else helping them, and it's very important for them to help the others. So that's been a driving force my entire life.
Exactly. And again, that's what we're trying to pull together as a tea club. One, creating network so that our student athletes, who I feel are really isolated. How do you feel about the teams being so isolated that they don't really branch off into what's happening at the university as much? It seems like they're really isolated with their team and their teammates.
Yes. If you're going to play college athletics, at least about my experience, you do not have the normal college experience. You don't have the college experience that you're going to have if you don't play. The trade-off is you will have friends, dear, dear friends, deeper friends, and maybe more friends than you would ever dream of. So you leave the college experience to create your team family. And that's the trade-off. You spend it. Back then with us, it was literally 24/7. I did not know people on campus, but I had great friends, and then that was a trade-off. Maybe in my next life I'll go back as a regular college student, but I wouldn't trade what I did, my experience at Tulane, for all the money in the world. I don't think I would do it twice, but I wouldn't trade it. So. But your point is right. That's your trade-off. You can't do both, in my opinion.
So how do you feel about the athletes, the alumni, establishing a network so that the student athletes can have somewhere to tap into for mentorship with somebody that actually knows what they're going?
I think that's wonderful. If that's your objective, to create this mentorship group, I think this is fantastic. And that's something I've been trying to do for the past few years, and it fell on deaf ears under the prior administration, as did a number of my requests. So
I can relate somewhat to what you're speaking of right now, Harold.
You know, one of the things that I've been trying to do, Carmen, is to give proper permanent recognition in the form of a plaque to honor the first black athletes. And I hope I'm not being disrespectful, black or African American
You're not being disrespectful.
I want to honor them. And I've sent, I've tried to create with their input and others' input a plaque for them. I mean, golly, Alabama has done that. If Alabama can do it, why can't Tulane? And that's one of my challenges that I'm working with Mike Arata and with the DA, David Harris, right now to see if we can make that happen. There needs to be some type of permanent memorial to know from the football side, the guys who came before them that laid their foundation, and they should, you know, there should be a sense, not of gratitude necessarily, but yes, a sense of gratitude and obligation that others have sacrificed. It wasn't always coming in and you have your instantaneously bubble of people who have welcomed you in. They went and they created their own. They were the trendsetters. So,
yeah. Trendsetters and trailblazers. I mean, we recognize trailblazers all the time. So it's not out of the ordinary to want to recognize those trailblazers. I think that's important as well. Yeah. One thing we didn't really talk about, I just want to kind of get your impression of, what do you think about NIL and what's going on with that nowadays?
What is going on with NIL? I think that from the athlete's standpoint, it's wonderful for them to be able to monetize their positions. I hate to know that the offensive linemen aren't getting the same recognition that a wide receiver or a running back's going to get, different kinds of money. I wish that there was a pot that they could, everybody for every school can get the same amount, funded by revenues that come from the television rights nationwide, so that there's some type of equality. When we were in college, we got $15 a month. You couldn't live on that. You couldn't buy clothes. You couldn't. So if your family didn't have the resources, that being said, so I'm very much in favor of it. But I hate the fact that, you know, Tulane's NIL may be $1 million or $2 million, which is what Alabama will spend on one player. So there needs to be some kind of equality. And secondly, transfer portal, I think that destroys the ability to, and I know you can get in a bad situation, but it'll be limited perhaps to once in your career, and you can immediately play. It destroys the fabric of the team, and I think that that's a real detriment to your college experience. You know, you don't have your friends that you will have if you're transferring 2, 3, and 4 times. So,
yep, it's a tough situation all the way around.
What do you think? I'd like to hear your thoughts.
About NIL, I think the reason I really like it, I like NIL, I think to me it's like a marketing. So, for instance, the kids that did Harry Potter, they're going to make a whole lot of money, right? There's some other child actors that don't make as much money because they're not as marketable. I think when we look at sports as being just a sport, that's where the issue comes in at. I think it's now more leaning towards sports entertainment when you're talking about the TV revenue. And I feel like if the money is there and the people that earn the money should get the money. So I do feel like there should be some basic funding that goes all the way around. But I also feel like the person that's the big market, the big draw, the one that's bringing the money in, should be getting parallel to what they have coming in. So I'm for it, but I do also feel like it's very hard to figure out how to make it equal. That's like always going to be a difficult assignment. If I can put it in a way. when it comes to the transfer portal, you know, as a parent, as a coach, as a player, I kind of agree with you in terms of how it impacts the fabric of the team. However, you know, if you go somewhere and it's not a good fit for you, then having to stay there is just, that's just, I don't think you need to have to do that. If there's somewhere else that has value for you and you feel like, you know, it can be of value, then I think you should get that opportunity to do it. Now, the people that are just jumping in, I mean, it says something about them. So to me, it comes down to the coach that's pulling this kid in. So why is the coach taking him? So if you jump in the portal, then, you know, there's an issue there. And if someone wants to take it on, I get it. But at the same time, I know that it's not going to always bode well for your average player. Now, those few athletes that are exceptional, I'll use the word exceptional, but are really good and just find themselves in a situation where they're not going to play because there's just a better person there. I mean, I don't really have a problem with it. Once, or, you know, I kind of feel like just jumping. I don't think that benefits anybody. So but the coach is the one to me that it falls on more so than anybody else. So now as a coach, you have to be honest. You know, we have X amount of quarterbacks coming in. If you come in, you're going to have to compete. If you tell them that from the beginning, then they should be more likely to want to, you know, feel like they can compete, you know, do what they have to do. You know, but again, if the player's not going to play, then why would – I can see if they could go somewhere else and have a better experience that they probably should do that. But coaches now, they have to recruit all the time. Like, you know, you have to get your team ready to play now. That 4 years down the road, or, you know, you'll work your way in, I don't know, that's not going to work for a lot of players. However, if you're choosing the school because you want to go to the school, then that's a different story. You should want to stay.
Right. It's such a changing landscape. I don't know that who can predict what. You now have basically only the Power Two, which is where all the money goes, and then you get another layer. And quite honestly, I don't know that I would want to see Tulane trying to be in the SEC or the Big Ten. I like where they are. I'd like for them to be able to have an opportunity to play in the national championship series.
Yeah.
You know, let them have 16 teams leave the lower echelon that aren't the Power Two. Let them have one or two slots out of the hopefully 16. But, you know, it's all about the money, all about the TV.
All about the money, and then them figuring out which route they want to take, because that's two different paths. You can get in the SEC, I'm just saying, or in a more higher ranked conference and make a consistent money, but you may not be able to consistently compete. Or you can steer from there and just go for that position to get into the playoffs every year, and then show your worth that way.
I'll tell you, I wouldn't – you talk about the Power Two. There's really – out of there, there's maybe what? Each of those SEC and the Big Ten, there's only going to be, two or three teams out of each conference. So you'll have 20 in each, but you've got 17. You're going to have a constant coaching carousel because – everybody's got to win, and I'm going to bring in the newest flavor coach, and it's a mess.
It's a mess. It's a mess.
Let me ask you something.
Okay.
You still have a good jump shot?
You know, as long it Jump shot would be the word that's just not working for me. If it's a set shot, I might be able to do it.
What do you think?
I'll be able to do a set shot.
What do you think of Caitlin Clark?
I think she's amazing. I think she's an amazing player. I love her fire. I like what they're doing for the game, creating the interest. I think that's what the game always needed. I think they needed that rivalry. I think they need that, you know, I'm better than you. Let's talk about it. You know, let's settle it on the court. That's, I feel like, has always been missing with the WNBA. They were just being nice to each other. Oh, we're going to be nice. And, you know, you have to create some rivalry. You have to create some drama. People have to be like, I'm better than you. Let me show you. And, you know, and that lets people, yeah.
How happy are you that women's athletics are starting to soar like they are now?
Hey, I don't like to use LSU as an example, but I love what they're, the NILs, you know, the way they're able to market themselves, that creates the drama, the people are at their games. I think it's amazing. The quality of the sport is good. And so that's part of it. So, you know, it's all about interest. So why is someone interested? Because, you know, they want to see you give it your all. They want to see you bring that fire. And if they know you're going to bring the fire, they want to check it out. And they work hard. The quality of the game has just risen dramatically. I enjoy watching it. I enjoy going to the Tulane women's games. They play really hard. They're, you know, really team oriented. So, you know, I like the state of where it's going. I hope they can stick with the momentum. You know, because it seems like in the Olympic years is when the fire is there and when everybody's very interested. And then once the Olympics fall off, people kind of fall off. So it's really about, you know, keeping the marketing going, you know, keeping the interest there. And I think, you know, just that rivalry between LSU and South Carolina, between the SEC, you know, before it was Tennessee and Connecticut, you know, they kept the rivalry going. I feel like women's basketball has always been of interest in March Madness. And it just has been some sort of disconnect as they went to the WNBA. You know, when you have people and they're transferring teams and they're changing teams and you only have a few teams, it's hard for people to kind of get behind them. But we'll see what this new generation does with all their influence and, you know, their marketing. Hopefully they'll be able to take it to another level. They can use all of it. You know, they can use it all.
And I know that Tulane could abuse you playing maybe 10 minutes a game this year.
I think
have made the NCAAs if we'd have had just 10 minutes, 5 minutes each half. That's all. Crunch time.
Yeah, you know, my thing is, you know, you just have to be tough all the time. Like, when I played, I was 100% all the time. That was practice. That was, you know, when I called the guys in at midnight, you know, to come shoot, come on, you guys, let's play. You know, they would show up for me. So, you know, I just love to play. And when I played, like I said, it was always 100%. I don't understand how you can't give 100% of whatever you are, you know. You should want to give 100%. So that's kind of how I went. And, you know, it pays off when you put the time in.
I hear you. In all aspects of your life. And I will tell you the competitiveness, yes. The drive, the will to win, the toughing it out during hard periods, those are skills that you take to your professional life, to your family life, to your communal life. It's everything.
Right. And you can be calm when the adversity is happening. You know, that's what athletes do. They can remain calm and make things happen, even though there may be chaos around them.
Don't underestimate the importance of just persistence and resilience.
Yes. Yes.
As they used to tell us, it's okay to get knocked down, just don't stay down.
You're right. All right, I have some quick questions for you.
Okay.
Shoot them out. Just tell me how the green wave rolls.
All right.
Would you rather bike or hike?
Bike. I'm a cyclist.
Book smart.
I'm a cyclist.
Awesome. Book smarts or street smarts?
Both.
You want to score or you want to
defend?
Work or work out?
Work out.
Would you rather sing karaoke or go to a movie?
Karaoke.
Okay. What's your favorite? What's your go-to karaoke song, Harold?
Oh, God. You asked me what I'd rather do. I don't think I have one. No, I would say My Girl by The Temptations. You ever heard of The Temptations? They were a group.
Yes, of course.
Probably before you were born.
Maybe, but I know who the Temptations are.
I sang that.
And I can sing My Girl too.
I sang that at my daughter's wedding to the chagrin of she and her mother and everybody that was watching me jump on stage.
That is awesome. Would you rather do board games or video games?
I'm not a game player.
No board games?
No board games. No video games. I'd say video. Oh, I'll play solitaire.
Would you rather a beach vacation or a ski vacation?
Beach. Hate cold weather.
Okay. Reading or writing?
Read.
Planning or spontaneity?
Spontaneity.
Okay. Would you rather go back in time and meet your ancestors or go forward in time and meet your descendants?
I'd rather go forward.
And if life was a movie, what would the name of your movie be? And who would play your leading role?
Let's see, that's a good question. If life was a movie, I've never thought about that. Well, obviously, my leading role would probably be Brad Pitt.
Of course.
If my life was a movie,
I don't know if he could play defense like you, though.
I don't know. I wouldn't go to any movie that would have anything about my life in it. So maybe it's a Wonderful Life. How about that? At least that's the title. Because it's been wonderful. Every aspect of it.
That's awesome. Okay. Okay. Well, good. So do you have anything you would like to, tell to the young student athletes? Something that they might, some advice for them?
Sure. Dream big and I'd rather shoot for the shoot for the moon and end up at the top of a mountain than not dream at all. So just dream big, perseverance, courage, humor, laugh, never give up. And find a good person to spend your life with.
Yeah, that's all great advice. Great advice. So again, Harold, I want to thank you for hanging out with me on Tea Talk, Beyond the Field with Tea Club. Hopefully we will continue to do some work moving forward. And I'm just so excited to have been able to have this conversation with you.
Well, I've really enjoyed it, Carmen. You are a Tulane treasure. And I thank you for sharing some of the beads that you caught at Mardi Gras with me. And
no problem.
And you keep on doing the wonderful work that you're doing. And it is so important to bring our young athletes in and give them the kind of mentoring and leadership that you're giving them right now. It's really wonderful, and hopefully they'll take advantage of it and help have them have the kind of lives that you and I have had, because Tulane has obviously been very important to both of us.
Yeah, definitely.
And the whole experience. So thank you very much.